Cliff Central. The Daily Maverick Show on cliffcentral.com. Good afternoon. You're live with us on the Daily Maverick Show on cliffcentral.com. Lovely weather we're having today. Greg is accusing me of spring vibes because I'm here in my t-shirt and shorts. I'm just feeling fly today. I'm just trying to make up because I couldn't attend the Bill Gates lecture that Greg wrote about the other day. I was dying to hear what the man thought. I know he's been working on some chicken, I think chicken vaccinations, and you know how chicken gets me. So I was waiting for more details on that.
He didn't mention the chicken, but he did talk about a lot of other sort
I'm
of
like,
vaccinations.
What else is there to talk about, man? Issues. It's like, are we what's the chicken situation? But really, really love to be back. Thank you for all the people who've been engaging with us on Twitter. It's really great to hear. Quick sort of follow-up on the sound issue I talked about briefly last week. When you're listening on, there's three settings, especially if you're on the Cliff Central app. There's low, medium, and high. So it's just really just jumping on and making sure you're on high and getting the sort of the clearest sound. Okay. Last week, we got a bunch of requests and people were tweeting in and being like, why aren't you talking about Zimbabwe? And our answer was simply, we just wanted to do it when we had the time to get it right and make sure that we were doing it justice, really. We didn't really want to just jump in and be me sort of ad-libbing the same way I do about chicken. So we've really taken our time and spoken sort of in depth with our colleague Simon Allison, who's been in Harare for the past week on the ground trying to really understand exactly what's going on and cover live in a place where it's not always the most friendly to journalists. So chatting to him and then really trying to give as much context as we can to what's happened most recently. So to give some context on what's happened recently is we saw firstly the hashtag This Flag sort of campaign and video. That's Pastor Evan Mawarire and what was just a 4 or 5 minute video of a sort of an impassioned plea by a man with a flag around his neck and saying, what has this country come to? How do we take back our country, our nation, our flag? And that really catching fire on social media and online and with a lot of people in Zimbabwe and around the world, Zimbabweans around the world, feeling this really sort of patriotic call to want to feel like the country is theirs again and asking, well, why is this the Zimbabwe we see now? With limited currency and currency shortages and failing economy and struggling on the agricultural front, the mineral front, and saying what's going on. And then we've seen that build up. We saw the import ban at the borders on a bunch of goods coming from South Africa. And that caused a lot of the vendors to say, what's going on? This is part of our livelihood is importing. And then we've seen this sort of spiral of continuous protesting. And it's unlike what we've seen in Zimbabwe and Harare for a while. So a lot of people are asking, what's going on? What's behind this? Why do things feel worse than they are? And also, could this be the beginning of the end for Mugabe and for sort of the ZANU-PF regime? So those are really the questions we want to dig into. And we've got some great guests lined up. So first, I'll start off with Professor Brian Raftopoulos, who's a leading Zimbabwean scholar and activist, a director of research at Solidarity Peace Trust, a former professor of development studies at the University of Zimbabwe, the first chair of the Crisis in Zimbabwe Coalition, and he's edited books like Becoming Zimbabwe, A History from the Pre-Colonial Period, and The Hard Road to Reform, The Politics of Zimbabwe's Global Political Agreement. Brian, can you hear us? Hello, Professor Brian.
How are you?
Okay, perfect. Good. Secondly, I just want to make sure our Skype line is working, okay? We should have Dr. Blessing Miles Tendai on the line.
Okay.
Oh, perfect. Dr. Blessing, I'm assuming that's you. Hello, Dr. Blessing Miles, can you hear us? Okay, we're just having an issue with our Skype line, but Professor Raftopoulos, if you don't mind, we'll just get started with you while we sort out the Skype angle of things.
Sure.
Perfect. So, Professor, I'd just like to start with, I mean, the big question, which is about the economy. And the news reports, if somebody's watching the news or following on Twitter, it seems like a country with a failing economy on all fronts. So I'd love to ask to just start with a really general question, which is, what is your analysis of the state of the Zimbabwean economy at present?
Look, I think it's been in decline for at least the last decade. You know, it started in the late 1990s with the problems around the structural adjustment. The disruptions around the land, changes on the land also caused major delinkages between agriculture and industry. So you had an increasing deindustrialization of the economy. And one of the most serious effects of that has been increasing informalization of Zimbabwe's economy. Mm. You know, historically, from the Zimbabwe didn't have a big informal sector. In the 1980s, it was maybe 11%. And it's now grown to the last labor statistics analysis, I think of 2015, put it at 94% of the economy of livelihoods now earned in the informal sector. So a major change in the reconfiguration of the Zimbabwean economy, and particularly huge deindustrialization. So there's increasing reliance on mining earnings and, you know, an emerging smallholder production units on the land after the land changes on the land, which need a great deal of assistance and help to grow into their full potential.
I mean, I hear you, and a lot of the conversation has been around the agricultural output and also the mineral output, which a lot of people say the reason Zimbabwe has been able to, I don't say survive, but hang on for so long because of such sort of abundance in high yield and high output agricultural land and also in minerals. Mm. What would you say is the state of that at present?
I think there's increasing problems around the mineral wealth. The income coming out. There's been major lack of transparency around the money coming out of the mines from the time of the global political agreement. Mm. When Tendai Biti was finance minister, he made complaints about the lack of transparency. Chinamasa, the ZANU-PF minister, made similar complaints. More recently, Mugabe himself has said $15 billion is unaccounted for from the mines. So there's a major audit taking place. So around the mining income. So there is a problem around that. There's certainly been money coming through, but where it's going to is another matter. Much of the social expenditure around health, education, still comes from assistance from the West. And that's from the period of the global political agreement as well. They put in a great deal of money into health and education, and that has continued despite the sanctions and the restrictive measures that money into assistance around the social expenditure has continued. So that's also helped the state to survive.
When I hear you. Sorry, Professor Villescuse, again, I just want to see if our guest has now joined us. Sorry,
sure.
Dr. Blessing Miles, tonight, can you hear us?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Wonderful. And the crowd goes wild. Sorry, sir, we've been having some trouble with our Skype line, so I'm really thankful to hear that you can hear us. Just by way of introduction, we're on the line with Dr. Blessing Miles Tendai, who teaches African politics at the University of Oxford, and he writes regularly in the media about Southern African politics and is the author of two books, including Politics, Patronage and Violence in Zimbabwe and Making History in Mugabe, Zimbabwe, Politics, Intellectuals and the Media. Thanks for joining us. Okay.
Well, thanks for having me.
So Dr. Blessing Miles, just to sort of bring you in, I'd love to just hear your assessment of sort of the recent, what seems like an increase in the temperature of the political situation in Zimbabwe right now. I mean, we've heard, unfortunately, we've been hearing for a while that things are not well in Zimbabwe with the economy, with corruption, with mismanagement. But it seems like recently, over the past, I'd say, month or so, 6 weeks, that something has changed. Is it that things are especially bad, or what's your assessment of what's going on right now?
I think Brian captured very well the underlying economic reasons why Zimbabwe is in this difficult position. So that's been there for a while. I think Brian captured that well. I think the thing that, in my view, the tipping point. ZANU-PF campaign 2013, they got a huge majority. And one of the key messages in that campaign was the promise of creating 2 million jobs in the 2013 election manifesto. But since 2013, the Zimbabwean economy has shed jobs, not created them. And then while that has been going on, ZANU-PF has been very involved with itself. For the latter half of 2014, ZANU-PF was almost entirely focused on purging the vice president, Joyce Mujuru, and her supporters from the party. Mm. That was eventually accomplished by about January 2015. And just when you think the ruling party will now turn around to focus on the economy, there was renewed succession problems. This time, discussion about whether it would be Emmerson Mnangagwa to take over and another so-called rival faction led by the First Lady Grace Mugabe. So I think a lot of it has to do with this. I think that ZANU has sort of fiddled while Rome is burning. And I think the electorate is now incensed with that. You win in 2013, you have a mandate, there are things you should deliver, but you're focused on internal politics. And I think some of that anger is at that. A state that's seemingly unresponsive to its citizens' needs, while its entire focus is on its internal politics. I think that's been what's changed and sparked these protests, the social media activism. But the economic problems are longstanding, as Brian set out very well.
I mean, Brian, you mentioned the economic problems, and I'm curious what you think the state can actually do about this. Is there a way to stop these protests, or at least quell the protests, without fixing the long-term and deep-rooted economic challenges?
I think it's going to be very, very difficult. Clearly, you know, Miles is right that the state has been consumed, ruling party has been consumed by its own internal politics, and simply has not addressed. And when it has moved, try and address these issues recently through Statutory Instrument 64. It was in many ways such a miscalculated move, because while, of course, in the long run, one needs to think about new forms of import substitution, at this stage, to do it in such a sudden manner, when the majority of the population have their livelihoods from these imports, has been completely disastrous. So I think their attempts to deal with the problems have been very problematic. The other issue is that at the moment, Their negotiations with the international financial institutions are largely around the repayment of the debt. And that seems to me where the focus of the IFAs are. They're not looking at putting new money into the budget. They just want to get their money back. And the problem is, if you have a strategy which is just about repayment and conditionality, you're going to create even more worse conditions for the majority of the people. So at some stage, any new development around Zimbabwe has to involve some kind of debt relief, because simply to have a strategy which focuses on that, I think, is going to just exacerbate the problem.
I mean, I hear you, and that's really been the big question, is what's the role of international players? Blessing Miles, I'd love to hear your take on that. And what do you think is the role of the IMF? Some people are mentioning China and the Zimbabwe sort of look east policy as potential saviors of the economy. What do you think is their role? And do you think they could potentially be the lifeline that ZANU-PF needs right now?
I think the ball is in ZANU-PF's court, in my view. There, if you're going to, whether it's IFIs or external investment or the Chinese, there are certain prerequisites that any state that would like to attract external funding should have, domestic prerequisites. And ZANU-PF simply hasn't done those. There's been demands for, you know, cutting down the size of the civil service. There's been resistance towards that. The controversy over the indigenization law, ZANU-PF has been resistant there as well. It's a lot about what ZANU-PF should begin to do itself, getting the prerequisites right to attract external money. That's important. Mm. And then secondly, I mean, to be honest with the Zimbabwean electorate, I think to get out of the economic hole Zimbabwe is in, there is going to have to be a very painful package of austerity in Zimbabwe. But in its current standing, ZANU-PF has not been honest about that, that this is what has to occur. And there's simply no compelling message about austerity to convince the population that we have to go through this pain for, say, maybe it's the next 5 years to be on a better economic footing. Instead, what the ruling party will talk about is sanctions, as usual, a message which I think is now exhausted. So the ball is in ZANU's court, in my view. It needs to get the prerequisites right. And then a message to the electorate, get the electorate on board, like, this is going to be painful, work with us. And also to be seen, is one thing to get the electorate on board, but the ruling regime itself should also be seen to be part of that austerity plan as well. There's no point making life hard on citizens, making them go through a difficult austerity package, while, say, ministers still get the latest Mercedes-Benz every few years or so, posh homes that they live in. They live well, the ruling elite. So they also have to be seen to be, going through that austerity with the citizens. And I think right now that's missing, and then the prerequisites for the external money.
I mean, some people are saying that perhaps this is the beginning of the end of Mugabe's regime and ZANU-PF as we've known it, which has been sort of the center of the Zimbabwean political sort of state for decades now. And I'd love to hear from both of you. I'll start with you, Brian. Do you see this as what could perhaps begin the forced resignation of President Mugabe, or see a weakening, a significant weakening of ZANU-PF? What do you think?
I think it's too early to call that, and it's very difficult to call that, mainly because ZANU still has major coercive resources at its disposal and is prepared to use that. And I think Miles has written eloquently about that. The other point is that certainly they're facing challenges deeper and much more formidable than they've ever faced before. And even a repressive response at this stage, in itself, it doesn't settle the long-term problems, but they could certainly hold on. And the other thing is that this current challenge we're seeing in the urban social media kind of protests, they're also very difficult to sustain. These are structures now which are much more fragile. They're not tied to, at the moment, any serious political structures or any what were once formidable trade union structures. So they could also dissipate over a longer period of time unless there's a new configuration within the opposition around a much more structured coalition and a much better messaging of how you tap into this reservoir of discontent and channel it in much more substantive manner.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, Dr. Blessing Miles, I'd like to hear from you on this, and especially in light of sort of a recent article you penned where you were, some might say, quite critical of sort of digital activism and digital revolutions and how far they can go and their, I suppose, their usefulness or effectiveness when trying to effect sort of large-scale political change.
I think they are useful, but only as part of a wider set of other instruments that have to come into play. As Brian was rightly pointing out, we really need, for say, formidable civil society structures on the ground. I think that is important. Social media activism tends to be fleeting. It's a passing phenomenon. But I think more key is the role of the military in times such as this of instability. The military's attitude towards that instability is quite key. And in a lot of these social media conversations, the role of the military hasn't come up, what side the military would take in this sort of scenario. And as far as I read it, for as long as Mugabe is still able to pay the military, I think they will stay on his side. So you've got a complete block there. I don't think Mugabe's downfall is imminent. I think if he is to leave office, it'll have to be around the 2018 election. And if elements that do want to see him leave office, i.e. the opposition, are to defeat him in the 2018 election, they certainly have to have a more coherent message, be better organized, better funded, and stronger commitment than is present for that to be possible.
Sorry, Dr. Blessing Miles, just staying with you. I mean, I find it interesting that you're talking about the 2018 elections. I mean, a lot of people on the ground, a lot of activists are really hoping that their protest action is a thing of weeks and months. And you're talking about sort of a 2-year project. And I'm wondering just your thoughts on how this kind of mass action and protest can be sustained, or this kind of energy and sort of united front for a more transparent, more equal state can be sustained for that period of time in a country where it's a lot of people are just focusing on feeding themselves and surviving.
It can't. I mean, I think Brian said it as well. It's passing, and I think I'm saying the same thing too. It's hard to sustain that kind of. But for me, the key thing is which side the military is on.
Yeah.
So far, the military is still on the side of ZANU-PF. And if the military remains on the side of ZANU-PF, ZANU-PF will be movable. So I think electoral politics is still the way out. There's a lot of disillusionment that past elections have been rigged. You hear these assertions. There's no point voting. Let's protest is the way to go. We must remove him violently because he's always going to fix an election. But my answer always to that would be, as I'm saying already, you don't have the military on your side. You're unlikely to succeed. Two, ZANU-PF has lost elections in the past. Mugabe lost the 2008 March election to Morgan Tsvangirai, so he is beatable in the election. It's whatever methods they may use to try to make the election platform uneven, they are beatable. So my argument would be, look, a massive turnout, overwhelming, and that in the election, and saying no to the ruling establishment, such a massive turnout, such a vote, would be very hard for the ruling establishment to roll back, right? The March election 2008 turnout wasn't that high, but it took ZANU-PF 5 weeks to release the results. 5 weeks while they were fiddling the figures, trying to, you know, engineer a runoff. So you can imagine if there was an overwhelming turnout saying no to the status quo, it's difficult to fix such a result. So I think that there still are opportunities with electoral politics. Electoral politics still is still really the main goal, or main game in town, I should say, because they see, with protests, they simply don't have the military on their side.
I mean, I hear you. And Professor Raftopoulos, I'm curious to hear from you on your view as electoral politics as the way out, and also what people are describing there being sort of a lack of ideas and a lack of vision aside from being anti-ZANU. So there seems to be a sentiment that the MDC has, some say, sort of crumbled, some say lost its way, but there's a description that is really, there's nothing out there. In that anybody who's not ZANU, the only thing they're saying is ZANU is bad. And some describe that as being the reason why Pastor Evan was so popular, in that he sounded like he had something refreshing to say in a political landscape that some say as being quite sort of scarce. Sorry, Professor Raftopoulos, can you hear us? Sorry, Professor Raftopoulos, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear, but quite faint.
Hello. Okay, sorry about that. I think we just had a sort of a mix-up. Sorry, just sticking with you, Dr. Blessing, I'm curious about what you think of, and this is sort of outside the scope of some of what you've written, about the role of South Africa. So a lot of people seem to be either saying that South Africa has a very important role to play, and others saying that South Africa must just stay out of it and has caused more harm than good in the past. Do you think that Zimbabwe's neighbor has a role to play in what's happening now, or what needs to happen between now and 2018?
Yeah, I've heard those assertions. I think it was Simon Allison of the Daily Maverick who wrote a piece along that lines a few days ago. Yeah. And my simple response to that is, South Africa's role in Zimbabwe from the Mbeki years, the Zuma years, left a lot of opposition actors and civil society members quite disillusioned with the way it managed the Zimbabwean crisis. They felt that South Africa had not done enough to catalyze democratization in Zimbabwe. So in many ways, South Africa's moral authority in Zimbabwe is diminished. And to me, for South Africa to turn around now, to want to have an engaged role once again, I think that the question of moral authority immediately arises. How do you reestablish South African moral authority in Zimbabwe, given its current depleted state? I don't think you can. Secondly, I don't think the South African government wants to get involved, that is particularly keen to be involved in what's going on in Zimbabwe. It had a difficult time being the facilitator during the power-sharing arrangement from 2009 to 2013, my sense and the South African officials I talked to in the foreign ministry, when the election occurred and Zimbabwe was now off the SADC agenda, the South Africans were very happy about that. It's difficult to manage. And South Africa also has its own internal problems, right? It's difficult to be engaged with foreign affairs to that degree when you have your own domestic issues to resolve. So I don't think the South Africans are particularly keen. And there's a question of moral authority. How do you reestablish that?
Okay. Sorry, Professor Raftopoulos, we lost you for a second. Are you back with us?
Hello.
Okay, perfect. There we go.
Hi, sorry, we got cut off.
No, that's fine. Let me
respond to your...
Oh, here question. We go. You remember? Let's hear it. Yes.
Yeah. I was going to say that I think it's not protest and election, electoral politics are not necessarily contradictory.
Okay.
I think that it's important to keep in mind that if there are possibilities of sustaining protests which are linked towards making sure that electoral conditions are better than they have been in the past and linked to a more cohesive opposition strategy, then they can be very effective. If you rely only on ZANU-PF to provide the conditions necessary for good elections, you're going to have a problem. The other thing is that the criticism of the opposition, I think that should be tempered. The opposition have done pretty much everything to win elections and have won elections. They've been active and the civics have been active since the 1990s. They've demonstrated, they've had stairways, they've had protests, they've had regional strategies of advocacy, and they've fought elections and they've won elections, and they've been denied the right to take state power. So it's not that the opposition have been useless, it's just that they've had a hugely repressive state against them in gaining power. Certainly, they've had the internal problems, divisions, they've lost messaging. But I think what we're seeing more recently is they're beginning to understand they have to revive their structures. They have to deal with the basic issues that have come out of this protest, which are poverty, corruption, inequality. And they have to get a much more cohesive message. But I think that the possibility of further protests to ensure better electoral conditions, those I think are still on the agenda. And we might see that linkage growing in the next year or so.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Professor Brian Raftopoulos, calling from Western Cape, and of course, Dr. Blessing Miles Tendai. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thanks.
Thanks for having us.
Okay. Bye, Miles. Cheers.
Okay. Cheers. Bye.
I like that we had a bit of camaraderie at the end there. If you're just tuning in, it's the Daily Maverick Show on cliffcentral.com. We're talking about Zimbabwe. It's been really a major focus of the conversation over the past couple of weeks. We've seen the hashtag This Flag Protest and seeing that catch on. We've seen the lack of pay for the public sector sort of wages by the state, and that's really sparked a big feeling of protest action. So we're really just like spending this hour just digging into that really and trying to get as much of a detailed and nuanced view as we can.
And I think our next guest is actually really exciting. We've heard a lot about Pastor Evan here in South Africa, but our next guest is also sort of one of the leaders of this protest who's been on the ground on a lot of these issues.
I mean, yeah, I mean, we just, as we wait to connect to him, I think for me, and I wish we had Simon Allison in here with us, but we just in talking to him and following his tweets, it's been for me, at least just from here, it's been so inspiring watching what's going on in Harare. I mean, seeing the people, seeing outside the courtroom when Pastor Evan was being sort of tried, seeing people like when they asked which lawyer here is going to defend him. And you had, you know, over 50 people putting up their sort of identification and saying, I am, because knowing that if you're the lawyer defending Pastor Evan, you're in trouble. Mm. So what happens when 50, 60, 100 people put up their IDs and say, it's me, it's us?
I think a lot of people seem to be inspired watching the events in Zimbabwe in the past week, just because there's been apparently a lack of sort of protests or what we're used to here in South Africa. But also, I think one of the issues is that, according to Simon, at least, who was in Harare for the last week, there was a little bit of steam, the momentum that felt like it went out of the movement right now, just because the pastor, who is the most prominent leader of this issue, of these protests, sort of fled to Johannesburg. He said he came for a prior engagement, but then at the same time, you know, he'd just been arrested. It looks like his life could be at risk. And while you understand that, you can see how some people might be disheartened by who they see as one of the most inspiring leaders now leaving the country.
I mean, I hear you. I mean, I remember finding out that he was sort of here, and after finding out that he that sort of his life was under threat and he's in danger. And it's, I think it's that balance. On one hand, if your life is in danger and people are coming for you, you're clearly pushing the right buttons and you're sort of on the right track in terms of what you need to be doing. On the other hand, if any time somebody stands up and is a formidable force, if they have to come and be in Joburg or be in a safe house, then how formidable are you and how far can protest action and activism go if you can't actually stay and organize as opposed to organize and mobilize? And if you can't physically be there, then it's a bit tough. Okay, we're just going to go into a quick break and we'll be right back in just a second. CliffCentral.com. Good afternoon. If you're just joining us, you're in the Daily Maverick show on cliffcentral.com. As mentioned before, we're talking all things Zimbabwe this hour and just trying to dig into the recent protest action there and trying to give as much context as we can. Next up, we'll be hearing from Sten Zvoradzwa, who's the National Vendors Union of Zimbabwe chairperson. He's led protests against the vice president, who had an almost 2-year stay at a hotel, and Sten was a big part of protesting against that and saying what's going on. He's been arrested and he's out on bail after his involvement in the recent protests, and has spoken out really strongly about the new import restrictions. So we want to hear a lot more about that. Sten, okay. Can you hear us?
Yes.
Okay, perfect. Now, Sten, we'd like to just hear from you as a person first. I mean, you were arrested over the weekend for your role in the recent protests, and I'm just really wondering how you're feeling right now about your optimism around the protest action and you as a representative of the vendors union.
The spirit is very high and the inspiration continues to grow. We have in the past been limited to think that our issues are limited to only a street vending and economic situation of the economy, but we are getting to realize that our future also is in the hands of those in political power. Hence, the need for us as citizens to rise up and challenge some anomalies that are happening in the country.
I mean, I hear you, Sten. I'm really just thinking. I mean, as we spoke with sort of two sort of Zimbabwean experts, you can call them, on the first half of the show, and they spoke in their introductions about the increased informalization of the Zimbabwean economy, and that people are really having to they don't have access to formal work and are having to really just make ends meet however they can. And a lot of that is through being vendors, through buying here and selling there and importing. And I'm curious to hear from you why the recent import ban seemed to be the thing that really caused a lot of outcry from not only the union but from a lot of people in that position. What was it about the import ban that really caused that outcry?
It was very unthinkable for the government to impose a statutory instrument 64 of the import ban before they consulted the people that are concerned and the people that are affected. You have seen in Zimbabwe, 95% of people are unemployed and only 5% are informal employment, meaning to say 95% of people were just cut off their livelihood. And this would obviously not affect the very person who is on the street. It would affect the person on the street and the family behind. So it affected nearly the entire population of Zimbabwe. And because of that scenario, you have seen people expressing their anger, you've seen people expressing their unhappiness, not because they just want to be expressing this notion of unhappiness. People are tired of things being imposed on them, but it actually relates directly to their livelihood. So the long and short of it is Zimbabweans have got to the point where they're saying enough is enough. And if you are pushing for this agenda to have our livelihood cut, then you will rise up the bar and you will protest. This is why you see many, many pockets now protesting, cross borders, vendors, you know, transport operators, because everyone else is affected.
I mean, I just want to stick with the import ban. I do want to talk about the wider issues, but just my final question specifically on the import ban is just around, I'd love you could give us, from a sort of somebody who's a part of your union, what is sort of the individual impact? If I'm a vendor and this import ban that was put in is implemented, how does that impact my business, my livelihood, my ability to feed myself?
South Africa is our hub. That is where we get things that we sell on a day-to-day basis. And in terms of survival, it means our life is dependent on the border being open, crossing over, buying cheaper products, coming over and sell. And this actually pushes prices in Zimbabwe lower. Because you see, before there was this ban, cooking oil was quite tradable at good prices. But today, because of just this temporary ban, the prices of cooking oil in Zimbabwe just got up by more than $2. Meaning to say, if there is no control of the local market by imports, we suffer quite a lot. And in the end, we end up really not getting what you should get in terms of value. So as individuals on the street, we really need to compete on the open regional market, and South Africa being our first hub, and that supports our system.
Thanks for that, Stan. Just to speak a bit about activism sort of from a wider lens, I mean, it's been widely reported for a while now that it's that being an activist or being outspoken or being appearing to be anti-government or anti-government policy in Zimbabwe is not very safe. So people disappearing, I mean, you being arrested, people being physically harmed, people having to go into exile. So I'm curious how you live and face these challenges, and why you still sort of joined and chose to live this role, and how you still continue to do so despite these sort of enormous obstacles.
My life as a person is very simple. I need to survive a life that is free. But since the age of 11 up to today, I've never survived a life that is free. We've attained independence, but in that independence, there is no freedom. So I got to a point where I say to myself, for the generations to come, I need to play my part. And playing my part is to stand up and rise against any system that will deprive people of their rights, people of their freedom. And because of this inspiration, I am driven to ensure that this life that I am fighting is beyond my person, is beyond myself. It goes beyond generations. And I will continue to fight, and despite all the risks that are associated with it. Yes, we know that our government at times is very ruthless. It kills people, it abducts people, but surely we need to be able to do it in a systematic way so that the system accepts. The beauty about what is happening now is that all citizens across the board are in one way or the other affected. Others have put money in their banks, but they can't get it out. Others have got $10,000 in the bank, but they will only get $50 per day. So everyone else is unhappy. And these unhappy moments create a force to rise up and protest and say, look, the government, which policies are you putting in place to protect us? And you will see this happening broader and bigger every day. And we are saying at this point, citizens are now being driven by problems to act. But you see, our government is good at blaming the West. They are fast to say, look, the West, you are sponsoring our Zimbabweans, which is not true. Zimbabweans are being sponsored by hunger, by poverty. They are being sponsored by the problems that the government created. So long and short of it, we continue to do what we are doing because the inspiration is coming out of the need to correct our situation and to regain our freedom.
Stan, you mentioned that the recent policies and sort of the recent context in Zimbabwe is affecting people across the board. And I took that to mean that the public sector wages not being paid. I took that to mean the outcry after the This Flag protest sort of created, and including that is the import ban and the outcry on that. And I'm curious if you think that between all this dissatisfaction and recent sort of uprising, do you think that in that lies perhaps a critical mass that could begin perhaps the beginning of the end of the ZANU-PF regime or Mugabe's reign?
Truly speaking, ZANU-PF is done. It's gone. If you push a dog in the corner, you will sustain it for a while, but it will find a way out. But at the moment, ZANU-PF is in a corner and all angles have been shut. They can't come out of that corner because we have seen protests happening in years past and ZANU-PF resort to violence to counter protests. But this time round, they can't resort to violence, because if they resort to violence, it's as good as they are going to kill the entire population of Zimbabwe. And because of that, they are now timid. They cannot overpower the masses. And in the interest of trying to protect their skin, ZANU-PF will surely go. The masses that are being created around dissatisfaction are not only working because there are problems, but they are working together because they've seen it all from the past that ZANU-PF does not listen, that ZANU-PF does not consult, ZANU-PF does not learn. And because of this past problem, people are united under one front. Even political opposition political parties, in this day, they are actually doing one thing, agree on issues that are common, meaning to say ZANU-PF this time around is not going to survive.
Two responses to that. My one is just, do you think, I mean, we spoke with some guests earlier and they were quite adamant that without including the military or factoring in the military, that it's going to be very difficult for like a sort of a mass action or mass protest action to move forward without factoring in that at the end of the day, the ZANU-PF government is who pays the military. And until there's a way around that, the regular citizens are still sort of fighting against an army should it come to that. And you still sound very confident that even despite factoring that in, that mass action will still prevail.
Yeah, true, indeed. The mass action will still prevail because, number one, our constitution does not allow the army to be involved in the running of the economy, especially in times of upheaval or times of unrest. Section 211 to 213 of our constitution specifies clearly how and why the army should be on the street. But because the army themselves are not getting paid, they are on the edge, and they will not participate in this mafia thinking of the government to try and use them and dump them. So long and short of it, the army is not going to be involved in the fight against the protest. And in any case and in any event, only a few individuals from the army are benefiting, and the majority of the soldiers are not benefiting. Meaning to say, those soldiers will join in quietly behind the masses because all they want as well is bread and butter on their tables.
I mean, I hear you, Stan. I think I just worry that you're assuming that the ZANU-PF would actually follow the would actually care what the constitution says if it really came to the day when they had to use armed force to protect their seat in power. Do you think they would actually bother with the constitution?
At the moment, it may be very ironic to reset the constitution, but as it stands on the ground, they will be
Sorry, Stan, can you hear us?
Of those that are suffering.
That's fine. Sorry, you broke up for a second. You were saying about the constitution?
Yeah. I'm saying they cannot break the rules or tenets of the constitution because the majority of those that are affected in Zimbabwe seem to be agreeing on one thing. Even the Zimbabwe Republic Police, only the top brass that are benefiting from the ZANU-PF-led government and the top commanders in the army that are benefiting from the ZANU-PF government, they are the only few individuals who try and protect the system. But the majority are in sync and in agreement that things are not all right. So they won't win it, and they won't be able to run away from the tenets of the constitution. This is why you see today, even the police, if the cameras are out there, they are intimidated to beat people. Mm-hmm. They only beat people in corners. But when these issues come out on the open, they actually get so timid because they know the naming and shaming and all these processes to try and expose them are underway. Long and short of it, we are happy that all citizens are united under one banner to fight.
I'm curious that you say all citizens and all sort of opposition parties are united under one banner, because I mean, what a lot of people are describing is that's not the case. Is that the sort of the MDC is trying to find a way to be relevant, at some point embracing that this flag movement, at some point just trying to do something. We have, of course, the this flag movement with Pastor Evan. So as much as the country, as you say, is united in terms of what you describe as suffering, or at the very least inequality and very tough sort of economic conditions, a lot of people would say that there's not actually a unifying idea outside of people saying that they don't like ZANU-PF and that they don't like the economic conditions they have to live under. Do you think it's, A, do you agree that there's no other sort of ideas that are being put forward on what happens next? And two, do you think it's sufficient for people to just be anti-ZANU-PF, or do they actually need more creativity in terms of what they're trying to create?
As citizens, we have learned from our dark past. Today, we all know that there is diversity in thinking. People differ and people apply different procedures. But as a unified, formidable citizenry, we have come to realize, and these are lessons drawn from our past, we need to have forces run beyond individuals. When we are talking about the MDC, we should not be talking about Tsvangirai. When we are talking about National Vendors Union, we should not be talking about Stanley Zolwan. When we are talking of Zim People First, we should not be talking about Maimujuru. And what we are doing at the moment is citizens, we combine our efforts, and this is truly happening because I get so much involved in other areas that I've never been involved in the past, because we call each other now and educate each other to up our game in civic education, because ZANU-PF-led government had made it a point that we do not receive enough civic education or political education for us to make informed decisions. But now we are at that gear to be able to teach ourselves, groom ourselves, push for ourselves. So there may be pockets that are quite weak, but those pockets will not overrun the bigger picture in terms of running national issues.
Okay. Just sort of as we sort of wrap up, I've got sort of two questions to go. One, we've seen that Pastor Evan Maurire has had to, some might say, flee to Johannesburg because of sort of threats on his life and feeling that his life is in danger based on the profile he's gotten as sort of the anti-government sort of leader or spokesperson now. Do you see that as a blow to the momentum that's been built up, or a sign that things are weakening?
No, not at all. If you want to become a hero, it is good that you become a hero at the same time surviving. It's no good to become a dead hero, all right? But if there is means for one to retreat, it's good, but you will not retreat for forever. We are in total support of the pastor, and we also agree with his tenet as pastor to rise up and speak about the negative aspects of people's lives through government, through civic organizations. It is good for pastors to adopt such scenarios, because all along, pastors were quiet. They never used to condemn anything that ZANU-PF used to do. They never used to condemn killing. They never used to condemn anything. But this is a landmark development that the pastor has set a standard. And this standard is going to go years and years in trying to revive other pastors who were quiet and passive about people's abuse. The Bible doesn't support that, but pastors were quiet. So we as a nation, we are tapping into the benefits of every person who has got a bright idea. His publicity is great. His publicity is good. And wherever he is, and I believe he's in South Africa now, he deserves the protection and the immunity as a leader. Number one, South Africa must ensure that the pastor is in safe hands. And when he comes back to Zimbabwe, if anything goes amiss with Pastor Maurire, we want to know that where is he and how is he going where. So we are clear that abductions in the past were done, yes, and but we must not continue to allow this abduction to continue. So let's just call Itai Dzamara's abduction to be the last. And if that is the last, we also at the same time demand that the government must bring him back, because we are nearly or almost 50-50 that the government has not killed Dzamara yet. Dzamara is still alive. We are still optimistic. But if Maurire then disappears,
Unfortunately, I was hoping to have one more question about the future and what are the next step is. Unfortunately, we don't have time to get Sten back. If you're just tuning in, that was Sten Zvorazwa, who's the National Union of Zimbabwe, National Vendor Union of Zimbabwe chairperson. And we just really thought it would be important to get the input of somebody who's on the ground, who's dealing with vendors, representing vendors who are in an informal economy. That's, you know, majority of people in the country. It's people who are sort of making a plan and trying to make ends meet.
And he's also played a key role in the broader protests too. I don't think he's not just isolated with vendors. He's a key figure in some of the activism and protests going on in Zimbabwe right now.
Absolutely. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have. Thanks so much for everybody who tuned in, and we're seeing a lot of activity on Twitter, so it's a massive thank you to everybody, not only who requested the show, but who's asking questions and giving feedback and challenging us to do, you know, better work. Massive thank you to everybody who make this possible, especially to Greg Nicholson, who didn't say much during the show, but had a really, really big hand on making that all happen. It is an honor and a privilege to serve beside you, sir. Download the podcast, share it far and wide. We'll see you next week.
The Daily Maverick Show on CliffCentral.com. CliffCentral.com.